Hello, everyone, and welcome back to this week's episode of the Big Bang and Creationism podcast. The title of this podcast is Inflationary Theory Take 2. This week's podcast is going to be covering inflationary theory again, as the title might have suggested. After writing that scholarship paper I was talking to you about, I thought I'd give another try to present inflationary theory in a logical way. And the creationist claim this week is going to be discussing their arbitrary distinction between macroevolution and microevolution. So, we're going to get back to a semi-normal schedule. We'll start with a creationist claim, move on to the science topic, and then at the end there's going to be a little new section called definitions, which is going to be basically, I'm going to select a scientific phrase that I don't think is really well explained to the public, and I'm going to try to explain that. And I'm going to do that with each episode at the end. But first, I guess we'll hop right into some news. There's a bit of news. In Alabama, two anti-evolution bills were shut down May 11th. These two bills, one was a Senate bill and the other one was a House bill, contained the obvious teach the controversy language that creationists and intelligent design advocates like to use. One excerpt from the House bill is, "This bill would expressly provide rights and protection for teachers concerning scientific presentations on views and students concerning their positions on views. And the rights and privileges contained in this act apply when topics are taught that may generate controversy, such as biological or chemical origins." Now notice, once again, they try to single out evolution and the origin of life as if they're the only things in science that have knowledge gaps. But in truth, everything in science has knowledge gaps. Quantum physics, you name it, cosmology, they all have gaps in their knowledge. And here we see the politicians trying to single out evolution as something that, oh, there's only a controversy here, to satisfy creationists and advocates of intelligent design. So fortunately, these two bills were shut down, and so we don't have to worry about that for now. I'm sure they're going to resurface in the near future. So let's move right into our creationist claim, which is, I believe in microevolution, but not macro. And this is something that's commonly heard by creationists, or heard from creationists by acceptors of evolution. I've heard it from my friend recently, and so that's what kind of inspired me to do this section. And also, I've been discussing over an email with someone about this microevolution distinction. So we often hear that creationists will say, I believe in microevolution, but not macro, as if there's some kind of distinction there. I find it analogous to saying, I believe 2 plus 2 is 4, but 2 plus 2 plus 2 isn't 6. Because macroevolution is nothing but the accumulation of micromutations. That is, you have a lot of tiny mutations, and over time these are going to accumulate, and they're logically going to lead to macroevolution. Of course, then again, macroevolution is a pretty poorly defined concept. I'll take Kent Hovind's definition, which would say, I've never seen a dog produce a non-dog. So a dog taking this leap into a non-dog would somehow be macromutation, or macroevolution. But dogs changing within their own dog kind is somehow microevolution. Well, if creationists view macroevolution this way, I think they'll be glad to know that we wouldn't believe it either. If a dog gave birth to a chimp or something along those lines, obviously this would be a falsification and not a verification of evolutionary theory as we know it. Kent Hovind is actually equating macroevolution with something known as saltation. Now, Darwin himself said that Natura non facit saltum, and that is Latin for nature makes no leaps. If you'll notice that saltation is derived from the Latin saltum for leap. Now, Kent Hovind and others who equate macroevolution with saltation, I would suggest they go over the origin of the species, where Darwin explicitly states that saltationism would destroy his theory as he formulated it with a gradual evolution over time. History was a big part of Darwin's evolutionary theory, and that's how he formulated it. He had to get rid of this notion that creatures would just appear fully formed in the fossil record and there would be no intermediary steps. He said that would destroy his theory if there was a lack of intermediary steps. And that's one of the things intelligent design advocates are trying to do, actually, is show that there are these leaps in the fossil record and that it would be detrimental to Darwin's theory. So macroevolution, instead of Kent Hovind's quick jumps, that saltation that he was talking of, time is actually essential to macroevolution. Without these gradual changes over time, evolution cannot explain the diversity of life on Earth. If we expect to directly see a line of dogs turn poof into another kind, which is, of course, a poorly defined concept in itself, it's really misunderstanding how evolution actually works. Besides, macroevolution is very well evidenced by the fossil record. Now, some specific lineages I would suggest that we look at are the horse and the whale. These two are very complete and show us how obvious macroevolution actually is. I will post some links to those two evolutionary chains, but I'm sure you could find them on Google if you just browse very quickly. They're very complete and great examples of macroevolution visible in the fossil record. So ultimately, to make this division between micro and macroevolution is really arbitrary. One logically leads to another. The accumulation of micromutations is going to lead to macroevolution. Just like if you keep adding two to the end of a sum, you're going to get a larger sum. So that is the creationist claim for this week. All right. Now, as I stated in the last episode, or earlier in this episode, I wrote a scholarship paper recently on inflation theory that helped me to understand a bit better what this theory is actually about. I mean, I had read Guth's book, and I found it slightly confusing, but that's what I basically had expected from reading a book on inflation theory. It's not a simple concept, which is one of the problems I'm going to have today in trying to explain it to you guys in a logical manner, in a way that makes sense to you. I'm going to have a lot of trouble with that, so feel free to also email me. I guess I'll give up my email now. It is rlippens, that's L-I-P-P-E-N-S, at wavecable.com, so feel free to email me with questions and I'll try to answer them. I've personally found that if I try to teach about these sort of things, that it's going to make the most sense to me. And I think this holds true for everyone else. If you're able to coherently explain something, it makes it easier for you and the other person to be able to understand, and so hopefully by trying to make sense of it for you guys, it'll also begin to make more sense to me. So that's what I'm going to be doing today, discussing inflationary theory, and specifically the mechanism of inflation, what actually causes it. Last time I briefly glossed over it and went on to talk about string theory, but this time I'm going to be actually talking about the mechanism behind inflation, what causes inflation to explain the universe that we have as of now. What caused this rapid expansion of space itself? So last time I just talked about the problems and how inflation solves it, but we're going to see how inflation solves it. That's going to be the topic of this week. So as I said, last time I briefly went over what inflation explained. And now I'm going to talk about the mechanism, but first we're going to do a bit of a recap to see what problems it actually solved. Now, for those of you who listened way back when I came up with this episode, it was a while ago, there were three problems I mentioned that inflation solved. They were the horizon problem, the flatness problem, and the monopole problem. Now, the monopole and the horizon problem are kind of linked with one another, so solving the horizon problem is going to solve the monopole problem. Solving the horizon problem, the fact that the cosmic background radiation is the same on both sides of the universe, even though they aren't really connected with one another, I'll get to that in a second, it's pretty simple with inflation theory. If space were to expand at a rate faster than light, then the radiation on both sides of the universe would be stretched out to these distances, and so that's why they would be linked. Now, the problem with the horizon problem, the issue was this. The two regions of the observable universe, is about 26 billion light years across, and it's only 13 billion years old. So the question is, how can the radiation on the furthest reaches of the universe, say all the way to the right of our view, and all the way to the left, which is 26 billion light years across, how could they have touched one another if the universe has only been around 13 billion years and nothing can really travel faster than the speed of light? So if nothing can travel faster than the speed of light, these two regions should not be the same because they have no way to communicate with one another. There's nothing connecting them. The light has not reached the furthest to the left to the furthest to the right. It can't go that far in this little amount of time. So, with inflation, if the universe were to expand at a speed faster than the speed of light, we would have this one region of the universe and the other, and they would be casually connected because beforehand, the radiation in this tiny zone would be kind of spread out over this gigantic area, and this gigantic area, of course, would be expanded via inflation. And so that's why we would have this large region. And some of you might be asking, well, if nothing can travel faster than the speed of light, How is inflation able to do this? How is it able to go faster than the speed of light? Aren't we breaking Einstein's rule that you cannot go faster than the speed of light? Now, this is a common question I'm asked, and the explanation is rather simple. It's that the speed of light limit only acts on massive particles in space and not on space itself. For instance, you can't accelerate a proton to the speed of light because it has mass. It takes an infinite amount of energy to accelerate a massive object to the speed of light. And a photon itself is limited to go the speed of light and nothing else. So those things that are in space, are limited by the speed of light barrier. However, space itself has no such limit, and it is able to expand basically as fast as it wants to. So if you were wondering how space is able to break that barrier, it's really not a barrier that applies to space itself. It's like saying, well, the cars on the road can't go faster than, say, 70 miles an hour, but the road itself has no such limit on it. It's able to go as fast as it wants, which is kind of odd since roads don't actually move like that. But that's as best of an analogy I can come up with on the top of my head. So, that's how the horizon problem was solved. That's how these two regions could be casually connected. And that involves space rapidly expanding faster than the speed of light. And this also solves the monopole problem. A monopole is simply a magnetic object with one pole. In nature, they always come in pairs of two, but with these unified theories that we have in physics, this kind of monopole comes out of the equations, and it's a weird kind of object we've never seen before, but it should be there according to our equations. But with inflation, we kind of erase this monopole problem, we kind of get rid of it. And so that's how the monopole problem is attached to the horizon problem, and that's how it's solved. Monopoles are related to the distance across the universe, and at a certain distance we have a certain number of monopoles, etc. And so inflation is somehow linked to that. I'm not able to understand it fully, so I wish I could tell you more, but again, it's a bit confusing, and so I'm not able to define it appropriately. Now, let's move on to the flatness problem. This is the last problem that inflation solved. It was one of the major problems with the Big Bang Theory as it was formulated a few decades ago, and thanks to inflation, we were able to solve this problem. And the flatness problem deals with the supposed fine-tuning of the universe. That is, why is the critical density, and this is a number that's going to affect the geometry of our universe, why is this critical density so close to 1, which in turn makes the geometry of the universe really, really flat, or Euclidean? By that I mean two parallel lines will always remain parallel. In a universe that had a different geometry, two parallel lines could intersect, or they could reflect off one another and go off, turning into infinity. They would never touch, but they just go off to the left and to the right. They wouldn't be parallel as we know it. So with this critical density very close to 1, it makes the space of our universe Euclidean. Euclidean geometry is something everyone studied in high school when you do the triangles or the two parallel lines. Again, that's all Euclidean geometry. Now, when the critical density is close to 1, we have Euclidean geometry and two parallel lines are parallel. But the thing is, if we had tweaked the critical density just by a trillionth of an amount, really early in the universe would have either expanded and collapsed on itself, or expanded infinitely quick and gone off into nothingness, and we would not exist today. So, how is the universe's critical density so close to 1? What makes our universe so flat? Well, the answer is solved by inflation theory. First, let's look at an example. If you take a balloon, and you put dots on it, and you blow it up, if you were to look from the point of that dot, and you blew the balloon up large enough, the surface of the balloon, if you were on it, would appear to be flat. So if the balloon is small, things look rather curved. And that's the geometry, we're going to compare this to the geometry of space. But if you were to blow up the balloon and large enough and be one of those points, and you were to look off into the distance, it would appear to be flat. Just like on the Earth, to us the Earth looks flat, but obviously it's round due to our knowledge of the universe. So these two examples are going to help us walk into inflation theory and how it's solved, or how it solves the flatness problem. Now, if the universe were to inflate at a rate rapid enough, from our point of view, the universe is pretty much flat. It expanded so rapidly that we only see a tiny portion of the universe. The universe could very well have a different kind of geometry. It could be a totally different shape. But in our point of view, because we see such a limited and small region, it appears to be flat. This makes the critical density 1. Essentially, inflation was just pushing the critical density back towards this nice value of 1. And it was, in turn, making our universe, at least our observable universe, appear to accept flat or Euclidean geometry. And so that is how the flatness problem is solved by inflation. And thanks to inflation, we were able to solve these problems and reconcile the Big Bang Theory with observations. And now we have accumulated a ton of evidence for inflation, so it is basically going to be hand-in-hand with the Big Bang Theory as far as we know it, unless some new evidence comes out that is somehow going to falsify that, which always can occur in science. So, this was our recap of the three problems solved by inflation theory, and now we're going to move on into the mechanism. What causes inflation? What allows it to occur? Alright, now that we're in our new territory, I guess I'll begin with the old model of inflation, because there is an old model and there's a new model. And there are other various versions of what happened to the universe, what caused the Big Bang, but we're just going to go over inflation. I might talk about brain theory or M theory a bit later in some other future episode. So, to define the old model of inflation in about a sentence, it involved a false vacuum that was based on quantum tunneling that changed a scalar field that allowed inflation to occur. Now, okay, what does that mean? A false vacuum, we'll begin with that, is a state that looks stable but really isn't. If you were to take a rubber band and stretch it as much as it can be stretched, this is a false vacuum. It might look stable with your fingers there holding it apart, but if you did something like let go, the rubber band is immediately going to shoot up and take off until it's in its rest position, which would be an example of a true or a close-to-true vacuum, because we can never really have a true vacuum in our universe, so it's really not possible to have that. And then we have quantum tunneling. Quantum tunneling is a phenomena where we can have particles that are really, really tiny undergo these kind of changes that allows it to jump past energy barriers that couldn't occur by classical mechanics. For instance, if I needed 3 joules to go up a hill and I only had 1 joule of energy, obviously classical mechanics dictates that I cannot go up that hill and over it. But with quantum tunneling, particle says, well, forget it, I'll dig a hole right through the hill and go to the other side. That's essentially what quantum tunneling is. It's bypassing this energy barrier that's created in classical mechanics. It just goes right through it. And so that's one of the things that's with the false vacuum, and it's going to, in inflation, the quantum tunneling is going to set off this false vacuum. Let's talk about the scalar field before I coherently define what the old model is. The scalar field, is this inflation field. It's called the inflaton field, and it's going to be responsible for the inflation of the universe. It is the field that sets us off. Now, in this false vacuum state, we find that we need a certain amount of energy to actually set off this field to go rapidly cascading into this inflation. So if we were to set off this field, jump it out of the false vacuum, we would be able to set off this gigantic inflation. But the thing is, we're stuck in this value. Here's where quantum tunneling comes in. In our universe, in the very, very tiniest, if we were to look at space in its very tiniest constituents, we'd see a bumping frenzy of particles known as vacuum fluctuations that are basically drawing energy from space. That there's a bit of uncertainty in the value of energy in space. So we have these vacuum fluctuations occurring. Now, if we see the energy in space is kind of fluctuating, well, couldn't a large enough fluctuation create a leap to this energy barrier and cause the universe to do that rapid cascade towards the true vacuum state? Wouldn't it be able to cause inflation if we had a large enough fluctuation? Well, yes. According to the old model of inflation, yes, that is exactly what would happen. If we had a large enough fluctuation, we would have enough of a tunnel, we would be able to tunnel right through that energy barrier in the inflation field. And if we were able to tunnel right through it, well, then we would have our inflation. The field would rapidly go down in potential energy, and we would end up with this large inflated region. Now, before we talk about why the old model is wrong, because of course it's the old model, it's going to be wrong, we need to cover a little process known as bubble nucleation. Now, this was one of the very confusing aspects of inflation theory, and I'm not sure I totally understand it. But I'm able to explain it because it makes sense now, and I'm just kind of lost in the details, but I know the basic structure of what bubble nucleation actually is. The term nucleation here is referring to the fact, the term nucleation is simply a phase change that's occurring in a certain area. So nucleation occurs in a pot of water when you boil it. It's just a phase change. Now, bubble, in this case, is referring to the fact that when space undergoes inflation, it did it in a way that resembles a bubble. So if you were to blow up a bubble, that's what the inflation bubbles look like. That's the region inflation was able to cover. Now, if you can imagine certain regions of space blowing up like balloons or bubbles, then you have a decent image of what inflation looks like. Local quantum fluctuations, that is, quantum fluctuations in certain areas of the universe that are sufficiently large, are going to produce local bubbles. So, in Guth's model, the bubbles would have most of their potential energy in the walls of the bubble. So, in the walls of the bubbles where they store all their energy. So, when we had two bubbles collide, what they did was they would release their potential energy in a process called reheating. And reheating would lead to all of the particles we know today. That's how the energy was released. It would be converted into particles, as well as the background radiation. The problem is this. In Guth's model, he found out that inflation in his model would not lead to reheating. There would be no particles in the universe except for those vacuum fluctuations which are constantly appearing and disappearing. We would have no actual particles. And without the background, we would have no background radiation either. And so the universe as we know it would not exist. So obviously Guth's model needed some tweaking. So we came up with new inflation. New inflation kept the same basic model of the vacuum fluctuations causing a shift in the energy in the inflaton field, and it would cause it to cascade and cause inflation. But he reshaped the field slightly that did the inflating, so the inflaton field got changed a bit. What it would do is we wouldn't need a huge vacuum fluctuation, it would basically kind of roll down this hill of potential energy. And this let inflation occur in a way that also allowed the reheating process. And odd things came out of this calculation, though. The universe is going to inflate indefinitely, so it basically be inflating forever. This is known as chaotic inflation. And I'm also going to probably post two images of what inflation theory is actually saying. These two graphs, I'm talking about potential energy rolling down a hill, and I'm sure you're thinking, what is he talking about? So I'm going to probably provide two images so you can compare the two and see what exactly I'm talking about, because I'm sure I'm just confusing you a lot now. So we remembered how the quantum fluctuations can cause jumps in energy. Well, we're going to talk about the expansion of the universe and how it can inflate indefinitely. What part of the new inflation causes this indefinite inflation? Well, these quantum fluctuations in new inflation continually cause the value of this inflation field to jump up. And as it jumps up, new inflation bubbles can form. They can now exponentially expand until it runs out of potential energy. And certain regions that are rife with these jumps in energy will have a lot of inflation. Others won't have any. It all depends on how much potential energy the inflation field has. If it has none, we won't get any more expansion. If it has some, quantum effects can bring it right back up and inflation can begin again, and this will occur indefinitely into the future. However, and I don't understand quite why, inflation can't actually go indefinitely into the past. It's got to begin somewhere, and so we're still stuck with what caused the initial inflation. So we're stuck with that basically until we can come up with a different theory. So that is my basic explanation of inflation. I'm sorry if I just confused everyone, but I decided I'd give it a shot and see if I could explain it a little more coherently. So if you have any questions, again, feel free to email me and I'll be happy to explain it to you as best as I can in words. And for those of you having a hard time visualizing those two potential energy inflation field graphs I was talking about, well, I'll provide some pictures so you can be better able to see what exactly I'm talking about. Alright, so before we wrap up this week's podcast, I'm going to provide a little definition so that we can better understand certain terms in science that I haven't seen to be really well defined, and so we're going to be discussing them. This week's definition is going to be on allopatric speciation. Now, I mentioned last week that scientists really don't care if you know the difference between allopatric and sympatric speciation, but, well, I do, so we're going to be discussing allopatric speciation in a bit. Allopatric speciation versus sympatric speciation is defined as allopatric speciation is going to occur in regions of geography that are separated from one another. Populations that are separated in geography are going to undergo different mutations based on their different needs and their environments, and these are going to lead to different species over time. Sympatric speciation is actually going to occur within the same species, which some scientists don't even think occurs. So, this is the view that Darwin had changed to from allopatric speciation, but ironically enough, we're kind of tending towards the other way with allopatric speciation. And so, again, allopatric speciation is taking related species that are changing in separate, non-overlapping areas in geography. So, if we were to form a mountain, say, right in the middle of these two species, and on one side of the mountain we had desert, and on the other side we had a tropical rainforest, obviously, over time, mutations are going to accumulate, and we're going to end up with different species, because they're going to have different needs. This is the gist of allopatric speciation. Alright, so this is going to be the end of this week's episode of the Big Bang and Creationism podcast. I have a few ideas for next week that I'm just going to briefly talk about. I have been discussing with a few people about doing a possible interview, so that might be a topic for perhaps the next 2 weeks or 3 weeks. For next week's podcast, I'm most likely going to discuss the history behind pre-evolutionary thought. I have been reading that book by Stephen Jay Gould on the structure of evolutionary theory, and he's been discussing for about 300 pages now the pre-evolutionary ideas that Darwin kind of built upon to get his theory of natural selection. And I thought that would be rather interesting to see how Darwin's ideas actually arose in what political and social context that his ideas had arisen in. How did they arise? And so that is going to be the topic for next week's podcast. And for those of you who are thinking I might do an inflationary theory take 3, well, I might be doing it in the distant future, but I actually just suggest that you read Alan Guth's book on the inflationary universe and try to learn it for yourself there. I don't think I could do a much better job of explaining it than I've tried to do today, but perhaps when I'm able to better understand the topic than I do now, I might come back and try to do it, but most likely I'll just let inflation theory lay where it is, go discuss brain theory or M theory, and just move on. So I might come back to it, but most likely I'm just going to let it be. So that is this week's episode of the Big Bang and Creationism podcast. I hope everyone has a good week. I'll try to come out with these a bit sooner. I've been taking 10 days at a time instead of 7. So I'll try to come out with the podcast a bit sooner, but I'm just trying to make the best one possible that I can. So until then, everyone, have a good week, and we will talk next time.